Blog Talk Radio.
Here we go.
This is All About Wine, the talk show dedicated to the wine industry since 2009. Featuring winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Rod.
Basically, what we're trying to do in this program is just trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
From coast to coast and around the world.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that.
Post your questions and comments during the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. Again, that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. And now, All About Wine is on. Here's Rod.
There he is.
Oh, thank you, thank you. Thank you, thank you. All right, we're back on. And Mike is back with us this week. All right.
Oh, yeah. Wow, well, thank you.
Well, what am I getting, an echo?
Are you?
Yeah, a little bit there on that one I was. Yeah, Mike was gone, like I told you all last week. He went to Southern California, San Diego for the weekend, and he is back with us, and he was just telling me about his flights and stuff. And
San Diego. I was surprised that it was going to be that cool. It was landed in the afternoon. It was 77, and that evening it went down to 66, and I wished,
from
Florida, wished I had a coat. Because 66 here is coat weather, but
yes,
it was nice. And then, and when it rains, there was a song we talked about. It was it never rains in San Diego or California. It rained. I mean, it was like it was going to blow the hotel apart. And,
wow.
Yeah. The I think it was Friday evening. Yeah, it was pouring, and I've like. Mm. Are they having a hurricane? And I never got that memo or something, but it was terrible. yeah, really, really neat to area. And I'd go back. There were so many places there that I wanted to see, and I just missed. And I'm kind of bummed by that because there, you know, so many things out there. It's a great town.
Yeah, great area. Yeah, it really is. I like San Diego. I've been there, you know, three or four times, and I've always enjoyed the town when I was there. Yeah, that's surprising. It was that cold and sun, and they do need the rain. So, you know, that's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Coming in, you could tell there was, I don't know if it was just, you know, regular skies for them, but there was some kind of a brownish glow most of the late afternoon and evening. And I don't know, maybe that was just, because I'd never seen it that way before, but I thought I was thinking, was, is that smoke from, you know, what they've been the fires and everything? But I don't know. Couldn't tell. But
wow.
It was it was just different. But it's good to be there. I've never been there before, and I hope to go back sometime and, you know, make it a vacation type of a trip.
It's an enjoyable. Enjoyable area there. If I was going to go to California, though, I think I would prefer Northern California. I really like that area, San Francisco and all that.
Yeah.
Speaking of Southern California, we have a guest tonight, I believe, is from Southern California. Michael Jorgen? Is it Jorgen or Jorgen? I was watching some videos, and I saw his name pronounced a couple ways. But, you know, without further delay, let's bring him on to the show. Hello, Michael. Welcome to All About Wine.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure, for sure. Last name, pronounced how?
Jergens, like the lotion.
Jergens, okay. Yeah. Well, I was watching some things that you've been on, and I saw it pronounced Jorgens, you know, like it was Swedish or something. I don't know. So, you know, Jergens is a lot easier. A lot of stuff to talk about. I didn't say too much about you, And so I want you to start out simply by telling us where you're from and how you got into wine and anything else that you would like to say before we start getting into your Bhutan adventure.
Sure. So I was born and raised in Southern California, you know, beach kid. And, you know, about in my 20s, got introduced to wine and realized how cool it was and started going in deeper and deeper and deeper. And then next thing you know, I'm accumulating a bunch of industry certifications and writing a bunch of books about wine and, doing wine as my, you know, primary occupation. And building a wine industry in the Himalayas. So it's crazy, how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Yeah, that's the thing. I have to point out something though. I've been looking at interviews that you've done, and I've been reading some things that they've written about you and all that. And for some reason, every interview and everything that's written about you always talks about he is a young winemaker with a beard and tattoos. And I don't know why that was always brought up, especially the tattoos. I mean, tattoos are so accepted now, but they always seem to want to mention that. Does your tattoos have any significance, or is it just something you've done over the years? And I'm curious about that.
You know, it is astonishing to me how people always want to talk about the tattoos. I think I spent a significant amount of time and money getting some really artistic, creative tattoos done by one of the, you know, the top guys in the world. And so I think it's not so much that I have them. It's that they're, you just look at them and they're, you haven't seen anything like them typically. And so I think that's why people kind of lose their shit about my tattoos.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're not just I'm going, you know, you've got so much more going for you besides just tattoos. Everybody's got tattoos now. I mean, you know, I don't, but I mean, you're seeing tattoos on just about everybody. You go to high schools, you know, almost seeing tattoos on some of the kids there. So it's not a big deal anymore, but it just seemed like everybody wanted to bring up your tattoos. So I just wanted to find out if it was.
They're pretty striking. I mean, this is I have the kind of tattoos that, like, I'll literally be walking through the Costco and, like, someone will grab my arm and go, "Oh my God, can I look at you? Or can I take a picture with you?" You
know, oh my gosh.
Sure, I guess. Yeah, why not?
You go, "No, witness protection," and just walk away. Yeah. Oh, that strikes me as odd. Because tattoos aren't unique anymore. Well, the tattoos themselves can be, but I mean tattoos in general aren't unique anymore. So, you know, just all
quite the stigma, right? But quite the stigma against around tattoos, you know, back in the day, and now they're pretty mainstream. And so, yeah, you think of all the interesting things that I, you know, do and can talk about. People gravitate to tattoos.
And here I am talking about them too. But you know, it just seemed odd that you have so much that we can talk about, and yet, you know, in the interviews I was seeing, the books I was reading, and articles, and everybody always mentioned the tattoos. So, at least that clarifies it. It's because they are unique. That's why.
We've perpetuated the talk about tattoos on podcasts.
And yet again, look at that.
Again,
we talked about tattoos, your tattoos. Jeez. So I guess that's just, you know, you're going to have to start putting that as part of your name. You just Michael, the man, the wine man with tattoos, and maybe that will set you apart a little bit there. As if there's nothing else to set you apart. You have to be the wine man with tattoos. You do a newsletter. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I think for years, my friends who've been kind of mildly curious about wine, but not enough to actually spend any time learning about it, were really after me to give them recommendations, you know, like what wine should I drink? What wine should I buy? And I'm like, you know, I don't buy what you like, drink what you like, you know, spend as much money as you feel comfortable spending, like whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, I was on a plane and I was reading this book. This is right before the pandemic started. I was on this plane and I was reading this book by a relatively celebrated wine author. And the author was ripping on Chenin Blanc. And I was incensed. As a matter of fact, I'm drinking a Chenin Blanc right now while I'm talking to you, South African Reserve Chenin. It's spectacular. Chenin's awesome. And so I'm reading this book and I'm on this plane and I'm getting pissed. I'm like, what are you talking about? You're a wine expert? How could you say that Chenin? You might say that you don't like it. Yeah. It might not be – the style may not be your preference, but you can't say it's a bad grape. Like it's a great grape. So I get home I got home and I wrote an email to like 10 of my friends saying, you know what? If you want to try something new, go try some Chenin Blanc and get it from Bouvray or Savinier. They make it in a couple different styles. And screw this guy. I sent this email out, and they all responded. They're like, this is amazing. Give us another one. And so I gave them another one, and then they forwarded it to their friends, and their friends started emailing me. And next thing you know, I got like hundreds and thousands of people like emailing me for wine recommendations.
Waiting with bated breath for your next recommendation.
honestly, yeah. They would be like, hey, when's the next one coming out? And so then the pandemic started and we had nothing but time. And so like every week I sent out this wine recommendation. Like here, you know, Assyrtiko, you've never heard of this grape before, but here's why it's cool and you should go try some. And it became literally like all over the globe, people were getting their hands on this thing. It was kind of crazy how I never intended it to be the success it has turned into. It was just me telling my friends, go drink some champagne because it's pretty cool. But I think that's one of the things that's made it successful is the fact that I don't overwhelm people with a bunch of obscure information, and I make it kind of accessible and I make it fun and like, hey, and also, you know, it's not intimidating. Try this. You might like it. You might hate it. And either answer is fine. You know, figure out what you like and what you don't like. That's what it's all about. Mm-hmm. And so I packaged up the first 52 issues and I turned them into a book with the idea that someone could take it and like do a wine a week for a year. And at the end of the year, be, you know, pretty damn knowledgeable about wine. And then the book turned into a bestseller. And like, it's just such a crazy thing.
Oh my! Well, that's your newsletter. You still doing your weekly newsletter?
I'm still doing my weekly newsletter. Yep. As a matter of fact, I sent one out today on Sherry.
Oh. Yeah, they're
and people are.
Did you see where they're revamping Sherry? They just revamped the Chianti and different classifications, and they're talking about doing it to Sherry now.
I did see that, and they also changed the aging requirements from like 3 years in Solera to 2. So that mm-hmm. that actually went into effect. Right? You know, I'm not sure what I think about that. Like, on the one hand, it's kind of cool that we're evolving and we're trying new things, but there's a piece of me that's kind of like, The way that you did it before was pretty awesome. You know, people just didn't understand it, so they didn't buy it.
Right.
And so rather than changing, you know, what worries me when we start changing stuff is everyone plants Chardonnay and then oaks it.
Yeah.
And then you end up with, you know, the oak Chardonnay out of sherry. And I just thought the world doesn't need that. We need, like, more, you know, aged Amontillado.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is with sherry, I like sherry. I'm a sherry fan. But when they start cutting back on the aging, I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, doesn't that affect the taste? And isn't that going to affect a lot of stuff about it? But I don't know. I guess maybe they think they know best, but they've been doing it for so long. So.
Well, I think what it is it hasn't that just hasn't grown. If anything, it's a shrinking category, and you got to do something. I maybe would have pumped more money into some marketing and gotten people to try it and understand what it is and appreciate it. But instead, we're changing up. I'm doing my part, though. I'm sending out, today I sent out my weekly newsletter that was like, hey, everybody, Sherry's awesome. You should go try some.
Yes, definitely. I mean, that's a good recommendation for anybody who listens to the show. Drink Sherry. It's good stuff. And, there's all sorts of Sherry's from around the world.
And super cheap for the quality. Like, for $30, you could get just a 30-year-old Sherry. Like, where else are you going to get that kind of value?
That's very true, And, it doesn't take a whole lot to appreciate it either, because it's a very simple, easy wine or wine product, great product to appreciate. And you can get the sweet ones, and people tend to gravitate towards sweet, and you can get the sweet ones and enjoy it, and it can pair up with, different things that you're having. So it's something that I think is overlooked a lot when people start talking about wine. Sherry and port are a couple of the two great products that I think are ignored too much. So, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly, and I would throw Madeira into that discussion as well. That's
one
that's just spectacular that people don't even pay attention to at all.
Yeah, and it's just all great products, and people are always, what's a good wine to have? Well, try these. These are something that you can probably just really go crazy on. And ports, too. I'm a big port fan. And it's just so many of those are just so interesting and so complex that and you can enjoy them. Go on.
No, I think what we've done in America is we've turned wine into this big intimidating thing, and so people are afraid to experiment. They're afraid to try something. I'll stick with my Rombauer Chardonnay because that's what I know and that's what I like, and no one's going to judge me. Whereas buying some random Sercial Madeira or 20-year Tawny Port or something obscure, they may or may not like it, and
they're
intimidated. They're worried about it. Yeah,
yeah.
It scares them.
Yeah,
and what they should be doing is like food. Like, hey, this is weird, and I haven't had this before. Hell yeah, let's give it a go and see what happens. But for some reason, for wine, it doesn't work like that in the U.S.
And you're absolutely right. It's just like so many people get locked in on something. I've said before, they go to the store and they look at all these different stuff on there, and then they go back to their default wine, the one that they always get, the one that they always pick out. And, I've had this before. I've had it many times. I know what it's going to taste like. I'll stay with that. And they become intimidated, scared, apprehensive, whatever word you want to use, to jump in and try something else, be it other wines or sherries or ports or anything. And it's really sad because there's so many great, great possibilities out there on the shelves. So.
Well, and I think that everybody that's really into wine eventually finds their own palate, whatever that is, right? It could be sweet wines or fortified or whites or reds. And by the way, that palate changes, as they continue to evolve. And to your point, it makes me sad that the people that just buy that one wine for the rest of their life, they never get to experience that. They never get to go through that and find the stuff that really speaks to them and evolve. And that sucks for them.
It does. It really does. It's really too bad. Best-selling book. That's, congratulations. That's pretty cool. You are on your way to become a master of wine. Tell me about that journey.
Yeah. So, I think there's a lot of confusion between what a master of wine is and a master sommelier. Because a lot of people watch the Somme movies. And so maybe I'll start by just talking about, at a high level, there's two wine certifications that are the highest levels in the wine industry. One is master sommelier, which is very focused on service in the hospitality industry and pairing wine with food. The other one is Master of Wine, which is a broader focus spectrum on grape growing and winemaking and the business of wine and whatever. There's about 400 of each in the world, 400 Master Somms, 400 Masters of Wine. But the journey to get both of those certifications is quite different. So the Master of Wine, you apply to the institute, and if they accept you as a candidate, then you go and you have 2 years to pass the first stage, which is a exam that tests you on your knowledge of the wine world and also blind tasting some wine. If you pass that, you move on to stage two, where they test you in more depth on the world of wine and blind tasting. And so I got accepted to the Institute about 6 years ago, and I passed stage one my first time. And then when I made it to stage two, I passed the theory part, which is kind of all the issues in the world of wine. And I failed the tasting. Then I took it again the following year, and I failed the tasting again. And I took it again year, and I failed the tasting again. And I just took it again, like 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago now, maybe. And we'll see. I think, you know, the blind tasting is a 3-day long, spectacle, and you've got to achieve a minimum score every single day. And then you have to achieve an average score of a certain level to pass. I actually think I passed day one, and I think I passed day two this year, but I think I failed day three. So I think I'm going to have to go back and do it one more time.
Do it again. Do they change it? I mean, every time you've taken it, is it different, or is it basically the same?
Yeah, every time you take it, it's different. So day one is 12 white wines. And then they ask you questions about them, and you've got to write an essay about each wine, that the answers to the questions that they have. And day two is reds, and then day three is kind of everything else. So sparkling, sweet, fortified, orange wines, whatever, rosés, whatever else they want to throw in there. The wines and the questions are different every year. So and you time out. So, if I fail this year, I've got one more swing at it next year. And if I fail again, then you're out.
Four tries.
You can wait a couple. It's more complicated than that. They sort of do, like, you can defer a year, but you have to pass at least one part within the first 3 years. But then you get another 4 years to pass the second part. Like it's more complicated than you just get five tries. But essentially I've got one more bite at the apple. And if you don't make it, you can sit out for 2 years and then you can reapply and start at the beginning. And I actually know a couple people who have done that and have been successful with it and have become, masters of wine after failing out the first time. So, I'm 51 years old, so I don't know if I've got the mental fortitude.
Don't give up. What the hell? You can do it.
I will
oldest master of mine with tattoos.
I'm the Grandma Moses of Master of Wine.
Yeah, with tattoos. Don't forget the with tattoos.
With the tattoos. Well, I will say, though, for me, like, going through the Masters of Wine process, like, it opened doors I never would have dreamed I would even get to go through. I mean, the wine industry in the Kingdom of Bhutan is literally an outshoot of me being in the Masters of Wine program. So for me, whether or not I get the initials behind my name or if I don't get the initials behind my name, the experience and the process has been life changing. And one of the best things I've ever done in my life. So I don't have enough ego wrapped up into, I have to have the initials. I would prefer to. That would be great. But the experience and the outcomes have been far beyond my wildest imaginations. So,
wow. That's quite a testimony there for the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I've already won at the wine life just by participating in it.
Right.
And if I get to initial school, if I don't, you know, hey.
Oh, right. That's a great attitude about it too. I mean, some people, you know, obsess over getting those initials, and you know, if you can get the take or leave it attitude, then it's probably more relaxing as you're taking it. So.
Well, I think a lot of the people that are in the program are, you know, have jobs in the wine industry, and that certification means greater opportunities, greater salaries, greater everything else for them. Mm-hmm. When I went into it, I literally was doing it for passion. And so I had a different set of objectives going into it than I think a lot of my peers that went into it. And that, you know, you could argue it, they'd be more relaxed. On the flip side, you know, maybe I'm not taking it as seriously, or maybe I'm not working as hard as everybody else. I don't know. I feel like I'm working pretty damn hard at it, but
yeah, well,
you know, who knows? But it's a different, it's a different path.
Yeah, a couple of questions, though. Do they give the test in the same place every year, or do they rotate around the country? I'm sure it's not like a test that is always given. I mean, there's so few Masters of Wine, it seems like it would be a very limited. I mean, they can't give it in Southern California every year because people, say, in New York or New England and all that would.
Yeah, so they do it. They do it in. They do it once a year, and they do it in three global locations. So they do it in typically Northern California, London, and Australia. And that's the way it's been this year. Well, you know, Asia is, as you're aware, is exploding as a wine industry. And so, you know, there's more and more people that are pursuing stuff down there. But this year, just because of COVID and travel restrictions, they actually did it, I think, in 7 or 8 locations around the world.
Wow.
So it was pretty, it's like a big deal this year. Like you could do it in Toronto or, Belgium or wherever else it was. So,
wow.
But I think next year it'll go back to probably just the big three, you know, London, Australia, Northern California.
And between them is there any studying that you can do to help you pass, or just go on living in the world of wine?
Well, so the curriculum, it's kind of like the old guilds, right? So imagine if you were like in the Masons Guild, you know, back in the day, and you wanted to become a master mason. You know, you had to go prove to the guild that you were good at doing masonry. Now that could be mosaics, or it could be building cathedrals, right? Like, you know, the different styles, but you just had to kind of prove to the guild. So that's kind of the way it works now. You got to prove to the institute that you're worthy of it. But what they do is they explain to you in depth how they're going to test you. And they do like an annual seminar, and they do like some course days that you can attend. So they sort of lay it out like, this is what you're going to be tested on. We're going to do some mock stuff with you to show you what it is. And then you go out and you do what you need to do to fill in the gaps in your resume. You know,
so
if you come into it and you're a winemaker, you probably don't know as much about the business of wine. If you come into it and you're a wine lawyer, you know, you probably need to learn about viticulture. You know, me coming into it as like the passionate guy, I had to learn everything. So it was more exciting maybe for me than it was for some of the other
ones. Yeah, an epiphany moment all the time.
all the time, yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. We've talked to some people who are going through some of these, you know, in the past shows, but, it's tough. Everybody who I've talked to about, especially master sommeliers and stuff like that, they just talk about how hard the tests are. It's definitely not something you can just say, okay, I think I'll take these tests and expect to pass it. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, so someone was quoting me. So the Master of Wine exam has like an 8% pass rate.
Wow.
And then somebody else, I was telling somebody this recently, and they said, You know, the Navy SEALs have like a 60% pass rate. I don't know if that's accurate or not. It's seven times harder to become a master lineman than to become a Navy SEAL.
Oh, my God. And master wine, you don't get to kill people either. I mean,
you don't get to do anything fun. All you do is sit around drinking wine.
You drink wine.
I don't know if any of those percentages are 100% accurate, so don't quote me on them. But anecdotally, it's a pretty interesting statistic.
Yeah, really. You know, you start looking at it that way. That's geez. I suppose you can, you know, substitute Green Beret or any of those in for the second percentage there. That's interesting. Well, since you are doing that, and since you said that it's opened doors for you, you have started the wine industry in Bhutan. I mean, basically, from what I've read, it never existed, and you were you're a marathon runner. Is that one of your things?
Yep, that's okay. One of my things. Yeah.
Okay, so you were running a marathon in Bhutan, and you realized that it was a beautiful country, and you realized there was lots of hills, and you realized there was absolutely no grapevines there.
That's pretty much spot on. Yeah, I went. We were running marathons in dumb places around the world, like Antarctica.
Wow.
And had the opportunity to do this in the Himalayas, and I did. I had no idea what to expect. You know, like I'm a beach kid from Southern California, you know, like in my mind, the Himalayas are like Mount Everest, right?
Big old mountains with snow on it. Yeah.
Big old, glaciers, and, you know, you need like crampons to hike up to walk to the car or whatever.
You got to have all sorts of guides. Yeah,
Sherpas, and you need like oxygen tanks to walk around.
Yeah.
In my head, that's what I think it is, right?
Yeah.
And so we get there, and what I see instead is this just like agricultural paradise, like literally like Garden of Eden, just terraces of just these beautiful crops. And every single thing I ate was the best example of that ever. Like I remember eating a carrot and going to my tone, my group, like, holy shit, this carrot is like the best carrot I've ever had in my life.
This is so good. Like, and everybody's going, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, I was like, why are you, do you guys not have food where you're from? Yeah. So in my head, I'm like, all I have to do is figure out where the vineyards are, and I'm going to go taste some of the best wine I've ever had in my life.
Ever, yeah.
Like, that's in my head, that's what I was thinking. Like, you go to any country where they're growing stuff, and you find the vineyards, and you try the wine. And so
exactly.
I'm asking everybody, I'm like, where's the vineyards? Where's the vineyards? And everyone's like, we don't know what you're talking about. Like, literally, I'm at the taxi stand, going to the taxi driver. Excuse me, sir, can you take us to the vineyards?
Take me to the vineyards?
Like, I don't know. He's like, I don't know what that is. And so I finally end up at this dinner with these government folks, and I go, hey, I'm not leaving this country till I get to see the vineyards. And they go, we don't have vineyards. And I go,
why?
I get mad, and I go, well, what? How could you not have vineyards? This is the, you know, Garden of Eden. Like, what are you guys thinking? And I like start lighting these dudes up, and they're like, Are you high on crack? Like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, you must do this. You have to do this. I was just adamant. Like, if you guys don't make wine, you are failing at life. And they listened. They started a wine industry, and they, it took a while. But eventually, and I had no intention of being the guy to help them either. Like, I just thought they should do it because it was cool. And so I worked with them for a couple years. So like, hey, you guys should do this. And finally they're like, all right, we're all in. As a country, we're all in. We're doing this. Will you partner with us and do it with us? And I was like, oh, wow. That's amazing. And I had to think about it, to be honest. You know, it's pretty daunting to think about inventing something new in your backyard, let alone something halfway around the world in an area that's not super accessible. But
right.
If you if you think about like cool wine adventures, like I don't know that there's a cooler wine adventure than trying to invent an entire country of wine in the Himalayas, in the Garden.
Yeah.
That's
amazing.
I don't know what this is going to look like 100 years from now, but, you know, hopefully people are like, ah, you know, we're drinking this amazing wine because of, well, it's kind of like the Veuve Clicquot, right? You know, people revere the Widow Clicquot for all of the things that she did for putting champagne on the map. And now
right.
people love champagne around the world. And everybody kind of points to her. And this is not like an ego play, like I want my name on every bottle of wine for the rest of eternity. This is like, this is a chance to do something seriously meaningful for wine. And not a lot of people get the opportunity to do that.
No.
And if you truly can move advance the needle for wine in the world in a sort of globally relevant way, that is just something that, in my opinion, is worth doing. Like, what else are we going to spend our time on? You know, we could, I don't know, be rich or make an algorithm or have the most goddamn Instagram likes or something that's
yeah,
stupid.
I know, but yeah, but and it's really cool too. I mean, you know, you put all these superlatives out there, but you forgot the word cool. It's just really cool to do that.
It's super freaking cool to do that. Yeah. for sure. I got some t-shirts printed up that said like Bhutan wine and stuff like that. And I wear them out and people will like stop me and go like, Bhutan wine? Like, what the hell is that? And I'm like, ah.
Yeah.
Wait and see, buddy.
Then,
you'll see.
First question is, you know, it's like, where's Bhutan? You know, isn't it full of mountains?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. I actually, when I booked our trip to Bhutan, I didn't know where it was. I thought it was an island in Indonesia. And the only reason I even booked the trip there was because my girlfriend would not shut the hell up about Bhutan. Like the entire time we've been together, she's like, someday I want to go to Bhutan. Someday, Bhutan,
really?
Bhutan. And then, yeah. And then I got this opportunity, like this email that said, we're putting together a group to visit Bhutan to run an international marathon. The first one, would you like to be considered? And I said, oh, this is that place that my girlfriend's always talking. This is that beach place in Indonesia. Like, let's go. That sounds fun. And so
yeah.
I booked the trip. It was not an inexpensive trip. And I went to my girlfriend. I'm like, guess what, baby? I'm taking you to Bhutan, your bucket list destination. And she goes, wait, we're going to the Himalayas? And I'm like, wait, no.
No,
what
no.
are you talking about?
Bhutan.
We're going to the Himalayas. We're going to Bhutan. It's that island. And he goes, no, it's not. It's in the Himalayas. So I didn't even know where it was. So, yeah, pretty crazy. I mean, the whole adventure, start to finish, has been just one weird thing that happened after another. And I think the only common link between all of them is at every juncture – I was like, sure, let's go for that. Sure, let's go
yeah.
for that.
Yeah, we'll do that.
Yeah, let's go. And,
okay,
and
now.
Here we are.
Bhutan wine industry. Okay, what grapes? You have some planted, right, at this time?
Yeah, we have 8 vineyards. 6 of the vineyards are in their 4th season, and 2 of the vineyards are in their 2nd season. And
so you're getting grapes already.
Them. Oh, yeah, we're getting grapes already. Last year and this year, there was obviously pandemic pressures in Bhutan. Being a small country, you know, was really, really restrictive about people coming into the country. So we'll make our first wine next summer. And actually, I'm doing – so check this out, because this is a really cool idea. Imagine if you had the first bottle of wine ever commercially produced in the United States. I mean, that bottle
wow.
would be in the Smithsonian Institution. Right?
Oh,
so if
would,
you had the
yeah.
first bottle of wine ever produced in France, you know, that bottle of wine would be in the Louvre. I'm about to produce the first bottle of wine ever in a country. And so our plan is, like, we want to make, like, and take the very first barrel and actually, you know, bottle it up in a real special bottling and hand number them and have a really, you know, nice box designed and offer those to kind of, obviously the country itself will probably get, you know, the first 10 or 12. Give them away to museums or to collectors or kind of share them with the world. And to have, you know, part of the first barrel ever produced in a country is really, really cool.
Right. Yeah. And you don't get that anymore.
So so it's getting harder and harder. We're running out of countries to produce the first bottle of wine.
Don't make wine yet.
Most places that can make wine have for a long, long time.
Right.
So, yeah, that'll happen next summer. God willing, hopefully there's no massive thunderstorms or, you know, other crazy things. But, yeah, that's
avalanches.
The plan.
Avalanches. What grapes do you are growing now?
This is the million-dollar question because we have – so Bhutan runs from about 500 feet in altitude on the south side of the country to about 27,000 feet in altitude on the north side of the country. And
wow.
That happens in the span of about 200 or 300 miles. So
the
literally
whole country's uphill.
It's all uphill, yeah.
Yeah.
And so we have kind of every climate zone known to man. We have like literal jungle, like monkeys, elephants, tigers, bananas, jungle at the bottom. And we have, you know, glacier, Himalayan glacier at the north end. So I have all these different climate zones. So for us, it's kind of a question of figuring out, and our vineyards are planted between like 3,000 feet and 9,000 feet right now. And so for us, it's really trying to figure out like which varietals are going to grow at which levels the best. So right now I'm planting a bunch of stuff to see what's going to work the best and see what's going to take the best shape. But to that end, we've planted 5 whites and 8 different reds. And the whites are Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Riesling, Chenin, Tiet Man Sang.
Mm-hmm.
And the reds, I'll tell you the story about Tiet Man Sang. And then on the reds, we have Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Malbec, Pinot, Syrah, Tempranillo, and Sangiovese. So all international varietal. It would have been super cool to do like some indigenous stuff, but they don't have indigenous grapes there, right? So like, we might as well plant stuff that we think, you know, people might at least recognize. I mean, I could plant Ayurvedico and Jafark, you know.
Yeah, yeah, there's all sorts
great,
of obscure
but,
ones that you can, you know.
Yeah. But since we're starting from scratch, you know, I'd rather try to figure out how to make a Bhutanese Cabernet that was different and interesting, but still appeal to Cabernet lovers. Because, you know, at the end of the day, like, this is a really cool intellectual exercise, right? But at the end of the day, I'm a capitalist with a business to run, and I got to sell this wine. So
right.
I also want to make it accessible to people, and having some really uber weird stuff from an uber weird place is not necessarily the best decision.
It won't sell.
Unless,
it'll
be harder to sell. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So
do you have wineries yet? Do you have anybody that has actually set up a winery for you yet? Or have you?
No. So we have, we have the land. We acquired the land for the winery. We designed the winery. We have the blueprints for the winery. I have all the environmental approvals for the winery. We have everything ready to go with the winery. And then the pandemic hit and kind of lost the borders. So I'm waiting. So Bhutan went from like complete lockdown to, you know, no one can enter or leave, to a 21-day quarantine, to a 14-day quarantine. Just the 14-day quarantine was just like within the last 3 or 4 weeks. Once they kind of move to like a 7-day quarantine, we'll start to see some of the workers start to re-enter the country. Right now, there's not enough workers to start construction of the winery. So I'm all ready to go. like I'm literally ready to rock with breaking ground on the winery, but we haven't been able to because of the pandemic. But I have a contingency plan. If I can't get the winery up and fully built by next summer, we have a contingency spot, which is not perfect, but it'll work. And then we'll hopefully by then, by the following year, for sure, the winery will be up and running. So.
No, very good. The country of Bhutan, how has the pandemic affected them? Have they had a lot of deaths, or has it been rather light? What, just for my general information, I'm curious.
So Bhutan has actually been written up as kind of one of the shining spots in the entire pandemic. There's actually been a number of national or even global news stories about how well Bhutan has weathered the pandemic. They've had, I don't know, maybe 30 deaths.
That's
in
it.
Total.
Wow.
And they, yeah, but one of the ways that they've been able to do that is they were pretty, quick to move and completely lock the borders down pretty early on.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing that they did was they vaccinated the entire country in 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
So that, not a lot of people like debating the vaccination issue in Bhutan. Like they said, we're going to do this. And they did the first round, 95% of the country in 2 weeks. Yeah, there's some cool stories on it. If you Google like Bhutan COVID, you'll see some interesting stuff pop up. So they've been relative, you know, in the spectrum of countries that have had serious problems, they've been on the kind of the far good end of that spectrum, but they achieved that by locking stuff down. Yeah. Awesome for them. You know, the downside is my winery construction gets pushed out, and I'm happy to, I'll take that, you know, 100 times out of 100, you know, versus massive problems, but my winery gets a little early.
Exactly. That's, I have to say last year before last, we received an email from somebody, and I don't know why or how or something, but they mentioned in the email that All About Wine was one of the most listened to food and drink shows in Bhutan and Mongolia and that area there. I don't know why or if it was revamp, but actually showed a list of the different countries that listened to All About Wine, and Bhutan was one of them. A high percentage of the listening overseas was from there. And
that is awesome.
I was amazed. I really was. I was amazed when I saw that list. But so when you started talking about Bhutan and not having any wineries, I'm going, wow, you know.
Well, if that's, you know, if a lot of Bhutanese are listening to this, let me give a shout out to my boy Karma and my boy Rinchen and my boy Shearing and my boy Tashi. What's up, guys?
All of you guys.
But Bhutan has this really great rice wine culture. It really is super ingrained in their society, and so every household makes this traditional rice wine, and they call it ara, and they make it in their kitchens, and every family has a different recipe, and some make a more fruity style or a cloudy style or a filtered style, and everyone would tell you like their ara is the best ara,
and
other guy down the street is garbage and you know, drinking his wine's the best.
And that was the original.
When you come to someone, ours is we've been doing it for thousands of years better than that guy.
Yeah.
And when you show up at someone's house, it's considered, you know, part of the culture that you would greet them and you would give them a bowl of ara. And so they have this, it truly, like the rice wine is a big, big part of how they interact with each other. And it's a big part of their culture. They just never had vinifera. It was never there. So they made it with what they had. So it doesn't actually surprise me that they're listening to your show, because I think there's a whole lot of interest and curiosity about, hey, you know, we have this awesome rice wine culture. We're about to be able to take it to the next level and add vinifera into that mix. And yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, and you really surprised me too that I've done, you know, different shows and talk about wine around the world, different things in Korea and places over in that area, Japan, a lot of these places make wine from flowers. There's a lot of wine from flowers, and not having any wine at all except for the rice wine there is really surprising.
Well, I don't want to say that that's the only wine that they have there. So they do import some bulk wine from places like India and South Africa. This is a more recent thing, probably in the last 10 years or so, import some bulk wine and they bottle it locally. One of the brands that they have is a brand called Takin, and T-A-K-I-N. And the Takin is like the national animal of Bhutan, and it looks kind of like a cross between a goat and a yak. It's kind of like this little interesting looking thing. It's about the size of a big dog, and it's got horns and hair and stuff. They basically, you know, have this wine that they just throw, you know, whatever into it. And it retails for about $1 a bottle. So you can sort of understand, you know, the type of stuff that's going into it. So yeah, so they do have some wine there. And then they have this other wine there called Zungzin, which is it's the same kind of thing. They import white wine in bulk, and then they dump peach extract into it. And so it's like, it's not fermented from peach, but it tastes like peach.
Very peachy.
It's a little peachy. So they do have some wine there, but it's not theirs. It's not an expression of their terroir. It's not indigenous. I think the whole country has been just incredibly behind this project, and the level of interest is just amazing. And I think, you know, it speaks to the concept of wine is ingrained in their culture. And now they've got the opportunity to sort of up that game with Vinifera, and everybody wants to know what's going on with it. I mean, to your point, it's cool.
Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, when somebody comes in and starts doing something brand new, it catches the attention of everyone. I mean, just, you know, Tesla coming out with his car, everyone pays attention regardless, you know, and so, you know, on any scale like that, it's something that people like to hear about and watch and follow. And, you know, a new winery in my country, that would be something that would really, you know, create a national pride, it would seem.
Sure. So part of it is the idea of being able to share brand Bhutan with the global world in a product that is people could get excited about. But there's another more practical aspect to this, which is, you know, let's assume that you're a subsistence farmer in Bhutan. You know, you've got your family farm, you got 4 acres, and it's, you know, terraced rice paddies. Well, of your 4 acres, you know, there's only 2 acres that are planted of terraces, but in between, you know, you've got slopes, and you can't really grow rice on the slopes, but you know what you could grow? Grapes. And so you're now looking at these farmers and saying, hey, we can take that land that right now is not useful to you to grow rice or to plant, you know, mandarin orange trees. But grapevines love rocky slopes. You know, let's fill in the areas around your terraces with grapevines. You'll increase biodiversity and at the same time, you know, have a high-value crop that's coming out of that too. So I think there's the pride aspect, but then there's the practical aspect that people are going like, hey, man, like, I want to do this too on my farm and you know, double my income, which is great. Like, I think – it would be really neat to see that model come to light over the next couple of decades. Kind of like in Champagne, right? You know, you have all these, you know, 10,000 farms, you know, family farms, and everyone's growing a couple acres of grapes, and they turn them over to the Champagne houses, and everybody wins. you know?
Yeah, yeah. But are you looking at becoming, organic, bio, sustainable, any of that, as you're setting this up, or are you just going to be making wine?
So Bhutan is the only carbon negative country in the world.
Wow.
And Bhutan is, yeah, and Bhutan is on track to be the first country to be 100% organic for all agricultural verticals.
Wow.
So they are, like, people from all around the world go to Bhutan to study sustainable agriculture and how you get that harmonious balance with the environment. So we are kind of starting with that as our canvas to paint on. Within that, there are, I'm not a total Rudy Steiner biodynamic, let's go chant in the vineyards. But, you know, I had the monks out blessing my vineyards, and I had, the monks.
It's Bhutan.
It's Bhutan, yeah. And what worries me is there's a couple of things that worry me. So one is there's monsoon pressure in the summer. That's going to create mildew pressure. And it's just hard to treat mildew with organic treatment. And so we're getting, fungicides tend to work if they're not organic. So we're experimenting with some interesting approaches. So, like, I don't know if you've seen, like, in Japan with the Kyoshu grapes where they put the little hats over the clusters.
Yeah.
You seen this?
Yeah.
So we're thinking about our viticulturalist, who's a professor at Cornell, has designed some, like, cool umbrellas basically for the trellises. So we're playing around with that. So that's an interesting concern. And then it's a Buddhist country, so you can't kill anything. So, like, if you find, like, a beetle is devastating your crops, you can't kill it, right?
Oh.
Because it goes against, the philosophy of the country. So what you have to do is you have to create, an environment where there's beneficial predators or whatever. And we're still learning about all of that. And actually, I was talking to some of the viticulturalists there. They actually have really, really skilled horticulturalists there who've been growing these amazing crops for years. They just have never grown vinifera before. But I was talking to them about beetles, and they go, like, yeah, what do you do about the beetles? And you can't kill them. And he goes, oh, we make a night trap. And they go, what's a night trap? And he goes, you put like oil on the ground on like a piece of paper, and then at night you shine a light on the piece of paper, and the beetles like run there and they get trapped in the oil. And then like you carry the piece of paper like over outside of the orchard or whatever you're doing, and you like push them off into the So we're definitely like trying to think through those type of situations. And then there's new threats that maybe other wine regions don't have to deal with, like monkeys. There's a bunch of monkeys there.
Yeah.
Monkeys, not a big problem in Burgundy or Napa. Not a lot of literature on how to solve the monkey problem in the vineyard. We're experimenting with stuff. Actually, I reached out to my master wine network around the world, and I was like, hey, does anyone know anyone who's dealing with a monkey issue? And that was like, no. One person got back to me from South Africa, and they're like, yeah, we got a monkey problem. And I'm like, okay, how do you solve the monkey problem? And the lady's like, we just shoot them with paintballs. And I go, you just shoot the monkeys with paintballs? She's like, yeah. They never come back. And I'm like, I don't think that the Buddhist country, I don't think that is a great idea, just be shooting up the monkeys with paintballs.
But
you're not killing them.
You're just marking them with different colored paint. That's all.
Yeah. So we're thinking about like, Tibetan mastiffs patrolling the vineyards, or, you know, noisemakers, or I don't know. We got to figure out the monkey issue. It hasn't really reared its head yet, but I absolutely know it's only a matter of time as we scale that if a monkey finds a vineyard and like grapes are delicious, you know, they're just delicious.
Yes, they are. And it's going to happen, you know. And the thing is, you say noise, but monkeys are smart enough. They'll listen to the noise for 2 or 3 days, and they'll say, that's not going to bother me, and they'll run in there and eat the grapes.
Yeah, so so the monkeys are a problem now, right, for, like, other crops like the mandarin oranges. And so I was talking to the farmers there. I'm like, what do you do about the monkeys? And one of the guys I talked to goes, oh, you just put a bunch of snakes in the vineyard. And I go, snakes? Like, that doesn't, I don't know if that solves, that creates a different problem. He goes, no, not real snakes. You put, like, rubber snakes all over the place, and then the monkeys are terrified of snakes. And I go, but you also have real snakes. And he goes, well, yeah, we have real snakes, too. I go, well, then don't, like, people get, like, super accustomed to snakes being everywhere, and then they don't worry about it. And, you know, then a cobra comes in, and then that's a problem. And he's like, yeah, well, you know, yeah, you could have that.
You get trade-offs.
Anyways, I don't have the monkey problem solved yet, but like, I spent time thinking about it, for sure.
It's an ongoing thing. Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do is, you know, a year or so from now, we need to talk again, and I need to find out how that's going, all that, find out what's happening with, you know, the vineyards and the monkeys and all that. While we're on the subject of you starting a winery, you own another business already, the Southern Cal Rum Company?
Yeah, the SoCal Rum Company. Yep, I do.
And how'd that start? And what's why?
Well, so I ask myself that question too. But this comes back to the whole philosophy of, you know, you get to the juncture and you're like, yeah, hell yeah, I'm all in. Why not? Let's do it. See what happens. So this actually started in Bhutan, believe it or not. I was in Bhutan with one of my closest friends and my son years ago. And both my friend and my son are big rum drinkers. I'm a wine drinker. Like, I kind of could care less about rum. But we were sitting there, and, you know, Bhutan is, you know, you're sitting in this beautiful environment. You're looking out over the, you know, the woods and the mountains and everything. And we're sitting there and we're enjoying a beverage. And my friend goes, let's start a distillery. And I go, making what? And he goes, making rum. And I go, I don't really like rum. And he goes, but I like rum. And my son's like, I love rum. We should do this. And so I said, well, you know, we need a business model if we're going to do something like this. You can't just talk about, well, let's have a distillery. So let's figure out what we want to do. And so we said, look, there's a bunch of spice rum. There's a bunch of flavored rums. There's a bunch of tequilas. There's a bunch of vodkas. But there's really only one premium silver rum, and that's Bacardi.
Right.
And so what if we tried to make a premium silver rum that just had a cleaner, fresher, you know, just higher quality taste. And so I said, okay, that's a cool business model. Let's see if we can do that. So then we screwed around with the recipe for like 4 years.
Wow.
And we created a rum, and it was pretty good. And we kind of liked it. And we were like sort of giving it to our friends and saying, hey, like, do this. And everyone's like, this is really good. You should do something with this. So we're like, well, I don't know. So we submitted it as a sample to the largest spirits competition in the world, and we won a gold medal. And so that, we're like, oh my God, like, we actually might have something here that people care about. So I'm like, well, why don't we try to get it rated by one of the beverage rating institutes? And so we submitted it to the BIN network, and they gave us a 95-point rating, which was the highest score for a silver rum ever in history of all silver rums. Like,
oh,
they basically said, this is the best silver rum that's ever existed. And we were like, oh my God, this, like, I guess we did something cool here. We should sell this. And so we, you know, basically built a company around it and started taking it out and selling it. And it's been crazy. Like, our rum's been featured on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills and, you know, it's been this crazy wild ride of all of a sudden you have the best silver rum in the world, and people wanted to make mojitos with and rum and cokes. And I never set out, like, it was kind of like the Bhutan thing. I never set out to, you know, be in creating the Bhutan wine industry. I didn't set out to be in the rum business, but we were busy just having fun and trying to do cool stuff. And next thing you know, you got this, this great rum product, and yeah, it's been just an awesome experience.
That's all you make there is as silver rum. That's it.
That's it. That's all we make is this, we call it a platinum rum, but yeah. And we, you know, we won cause I, you know, me being a skeptic, I'm sort of like, but is it really that good? So like we submitted it to the largest consumer judged show in the world. We won a double gold. We submitted it to, you know, the largest craft spirits competition in the world. We won a gold. Like everything we submitted to, we win. And so I'm like, okay, like, but it took like 7 or 8 times before I personally even internalized, like, oh, we actually did this. We made a
maybe
good rum.
It is that good.
Maybe it is that good. Like, well, because you know, you got to think about like other people that have been, you know, Bacardi's been making rum for 150 years. Like, how is it that we're better than they are? Just randomly, a couple of Joe Schmoes from Southern California screwing around with recipes. But, you know, life is fun that way.
That is. It really is. Wait, you say Southern. Where do you live in Southern California?
I live in a little town called Caza.
No, I've never heard of that. No.
No, no one's ever heard of it. It's this little tiny town, but it's kind of like inland from Laguna Beach. It's about 7 or 8 miles inland from Laguna Beach. If you know where Laguna is, it's a little bit south of Newport Beach or San Clemente, kind of right in there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Just a little small burg inside of all those others and all that. And you are, I have to mention this too, a professor at University of California at Irvine.
I am, yeah. I teach in the business school there.
A business, you know. So you, that's it, a business teacher, huh?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm not just a you know, an alcohol tattooed guy, actually.
Oh,
my
that's
day
disappointing.
Job is, I work for I'm a partner in a large global consulting firm. And so I've been teaching at the business school there for over 20 years, actually.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, so quite a while. Actually, it's funny. Every year I say, this is the last year I'm doing this. And then every year they kind of convince me to come back again and do it, do one more lap. And I just started my class this week on Monday. My class started, and it's
just throw your hands up and accept the fact that you're going to be a professor there until you retire from that. So you know, don't fight.
You know, it's here's what sucks. Though, I'll be honest with you. You know, I teach the graduate students, and so you know, you're talking about they're grad students. You know, they're sort of, you know, adult professionals, and now they're younger than my children. I've become the old professor,
the old professor,
punk rock guy. Yeah.
Not anymore. You're gonna start wearing long sleeves to work.
Yeah, start wearing the jackets with the patches on the elbows.
That's right.
Yeah. Start smoking a pipe.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. But no, it's a great school, and I'm super stoked to be able to help contribute to what's going on with it. But yeah, literally, it's like every year. The kids just get younger and younger, and I'm like, holy shit.
I know what you mean. I know. We all get reminded of stuff like that every once in a while. I happen to be behind a school bus who's dropping off some high school kids, and you're going, wait a minute, you know, how those kids look like they're 12 years old. How can they be high school? You know?
Well, and here's what I think it is. You know, women, God bless them, and they're better than us at literally everything, right?
Everything.
Like, they
mature
and evolve. But, like, men, like, we cap out intellectually at about 14 years old. In my head, I'm still like a 14-year-old kid.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
it doesn't change. You're God. It does not change. You know, I'm like 20 years older than you, and still, I'm like a 15-year-old now. So I guess I grew up a little bit.
Yeah. After another 20 years, I'll make it to 15.
You'll make it to 15 too. You know, so you know that's that's what happens. But yeah, you're absolutely right. So, Mike, you still there?
Yes. Come on.
Any comments?
Oh, Jesus,
any questions?
We got somebody else on the phone.
Is my co-host. Mike is back in my co-host. He's one of those silent people that sits back, and while we're talking, he's texting and he's sending out tweets and he's, you know, making notes, and he keeps himself busy in the background, and he's the one that will take this show and put it in the archives so people can listen to it over and over and all sorts of stuff. He's the man, really. He's the man. So I always give him a chance.
Mike,
to...
I had no idea, buddy. I completely apologize for monopolizing the conversation and not letting you jump in.
Well, he
brings towards the end, and because I'm usually, like you said, taking notes and updating. We run like a little video feed, that kind of thing, on Facebook and Twitter, or not Twitter, Facebook and YouTube, and so I'm just to get some of that updated and the video ready for the outro, the intro, that kind of thing. But yes, I do have a question. Actually, I have a couple. And you answered one already about importing. They do import, and you said some bulk wine from India, they bottle it and all that. Why has it taken them this long to get into the industry themselves? Was it just because your spark said, hey, let's do this? Or have others failed, as far as you know, and you just did it and did it right, or what? What's been so long?
Good question.
Yeah, that's an awesome question. So I think you have to understand the political climate of Bhutan. Like, Bhutan was like completely closed to the world into the 70s, Even then, when it opened to, you know, foreigners entering the country, it was really strictly controlled until probably, you know, the last 15 or so years, they sort of made it more broadly accessible. So that's one issue. The second thing is that it was a monarchy. So it's a kingdom. There's a king and there's a queen. And up until about 15 years ago, it was 100% monarchy. And about 15 years ago, they were progressive enough, which is, I think, just genius on their part. They actually migrated to a parliamentary structure, very similar to England, where they created some democratization with a parliamentary body and a prime minister who would be kind of the head of government. And then the king would be the head of state, which, I mean, imagine if you're the king of everything to say, oh, hey, we should democratize some of it. I mean, there's a lot of countries where they never would have done that, right?
That's
or a
right.
lot of leaders
Very
who never would have done
wow.
that. Yeah. So it's just been in the last, you know, 15 years or so that they've been able to embrace like some new models. All of that being said, there is a gentleman by the name of John Goulet, and the Goulet family owns Taltarni Vineyards in Australia. They own Clos de Vaux in California, and they own some wineries in France. And my understanding is that Mr. Goulet was really close with the prior king of Bhutan. I think he's an older fellow. I think he's in his 70s or 80s now. And I know that he's the head of, I've never met him. So this is why this is just what I've heard. And so I don't want anyone to sort of assume that I'm the factual historian here, but Mr. Goulet is like the head of the Bhutan Foundation, which has been around since I think the 80s or the 90s. And it's a nonprofit that's designed to really kind of help Bhutan in a lot of ways. Because he's a wine guy, he had the same epiphany that I did in the 90s. And he tried to set up some initial vineyards. And I think they even sent a Bhutanese person to one of his wineries in Australia to learn winemaking. And they either talked about planting a vineyard or they actually planted a vineyard. And they didn't plant it in the right place or whatever. But there was a lot of discussion in the 90s about this John Galay working with Bhutan to start this, and it just didn't happen. So there's a piece of me that's like, hey, look, here's a billionaire with wineries on three different continents who tried to do this and wasn't able to do it. What in the world makes you think that, you know, the little punk rock kids from Southern California can do it? So there's that piece of it. But then there's another piece of it that says part of this is about timing. And, you know, the Bhutan today with the parliamentary system and the more exposure to the global economy is in a different place than it was in the 90s. And they're ready to hear it now. They're ready to talk about this today. And I do think, you know, there's some things that the government wants to do, you know, around like, you know, they want to share Brand Bhutan with the world, but in a non sort of commercial way. So you think about like, remember when we were kids and like you would get the little plastic toys and they all were like stamped made in Taiwan. And so, you know, like, the brand in our head was like, Taiwan makes like cheap plastic stuff. Whether or not they did or they didn't, like that was what our perception of it was. So I think there's this desire to share the beauty and majesty of Bhutan, but through products that express that. You know, they could have a cheap plastic toy factory there if they wanted to, but that's not really what they want to do. And the tourism side of it is a different game today than it was in the 90s. And more people are like, oh, this is my bucket list destination. I really want to go there. And there's new vehicles and avenues for them to do that. And obviously wine tourism is massive, as you guys know. So I think back to your point, Mike, yes, this guy who's better at wine than I am tried to do this, you know, 30 years ago and wasn't able to get it off the ground. And I've made more progress, you know, today than he was able to make back then. And I think it's a combination of a number of factors, and it's entirely possible. Like, I might not be the right guy, you know, I'm not Mr. Right, but I'm Mr. Right now. You know, I might've just been asking the right questions in the right place at the right time to be able to do this cool thing. Or I may be a genius. I don't know. Either way, but I wasn't the first guy to think of this. Is the bottom line?
Okay. And you've kind of touched on this already, but it sounds like the country, as far as we know, is going to allow exporting the wine when you do produce it. It is going to be a global thing, product.
Yeah, actually, it's the right now. Our entire business model is based around 100% exports. Our entire plan is 100%. Well, probably not 100%, but the vast majority of production is going to be for the export market. And actually, we should lean in on this because this is kind of interesting. We have a bifurcated business model. So on the one hand, we have this beautiful terroir that, in my opinion, is going to produce some wines that rival, you know, other great wine producing regions, just with the depth and complexity of what we can produce. And we plan to do that and export those to New York and London and Japan. Matter of fact, I've already been in numerous conversations with big distributors around the globe, including somebody who wanted a very large company who wanted an exclusive for the entire country of Japan. And this is like 2 years ago. I'm like, I don't even have wine yet. Like, I'm not going to sign an exclusive agreement. And entire country. But so that we're planning to do that. But then the second part of our business model, and this is where stuff gets really interesting, is India has a billion people, more than a billion people. And India has a burgeoning middle class, and that middle class is getting very interested in wine. Mm. And India as a country has placed some really significant taxes and tariffs on imported wine. So you might pay up to 200% tax and tariff on wine that's going into India. So one of the biggest selling wines in India right now is Matus Rosé. Do you guys know Matus? Like back in the day.
Yeah.
Right. So Matus is a $5 bottle of wine. And it, you know, for what it is, it's a nice, for $5, it's a great
value. Yeah, for $5, it's okay.
It's, you know, it's okay. So Matus in India sells for $29 because of the taxes and the tariffs. And it's one of the highest selling wines in India. And so Bhutan is the only country in the world that has a free trade agreement for alcohol with India.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
So we're going to plant a bunch of Cabernet that we're going to try to make, you know, a $250 bottle of wine that we're going to sell at, you know, 11 Madison Park in New York. And then I'm also going to plant some high cropping hybrids that we're going to crop at 15 tons an acre. And I'm going to sell $15 whites and rosés to India at huge margins, because I have a massive cost competitive advantage against any other wine company in the world.
Well, yeah, because of the tariffs. No tariffs, yeah. Wow.
Because no tariffs, exactly. And so that's kind of our business model. So back to your question about exports, yeah, we're going to have some percentage of our acreage designated to high-cropping varietals that we can ship to India, and another percentage designated to really high complexity terroir based wines that go to, you know, Japan and London and the US. Both of those are probably going to be, you know, we'll probably sell some wine through like the local high end hotels and stuff, but you know, the average salary in Bhutan, I think the average, don't quote me on this, but I think the average salary is about $2,000 a year. So that's, you know, whatever that is, a couple $100 a month, $185 a month or something.
Right.
So like the average Joe in Bhutan is not coughing up even $20 for a bottle of wine, which is fine. And I think what we want to do is if this works, you know, that raises actually the average salary of everybody there. Not that they're, you know, they have this concept called gross domestic happiness, where they measure the happiness of their people rather than the gross domestic product. But within that, you know, if there's an opportunity to give families the way to earn a little bit more money, you know, they plant the hills between the rice crops and they have a bit more money, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. But the country is less motivated by economic success than they are by happiness success, which I think is a fucking awesome way of living.
It's amazing. Yeah, so. it's a great way to live. Yeah.
Yeah. And they measure it. They actually, like, you know how we go around and we measure our GDP every year? They actually measure their happiness every year. And they want to know, are they trending up or are they trending down? It's really cool.
Yeah.
It is. Sounds interesting. Different.
That was a longer answer than you expected, Mike.
Oh, no,
sorry about that.
That was interesting. Yeah, I like that. So they measure, they don't measure your worth, but, you know, if you're satisfied with where you're at and you're comfortable and that you're content with yourself. So,
imagine that, like if you were judged not by how much money you had, but by how happy you were.
Yeah.
Like if that's what your measurement for your metric for success was, I mean, that should be the metric for all of our success everywhere. And somehow we lost sight of that here, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Which, you, you know, that would create a whole different outlook on everything. Yeah, so. That's cool. Anything else, Mike? Right.
Nope, that's it for me. I appreciate it. Thank you for the answers and for all the insight and everything and your experience, and very enjoyable. Really appreciate this.
Well,
thanks
again, guys, for having me on. This has been super, super great. And if people want to jump on my email distribution list that we talked about, they can just go to drinkingandknowingthings.com and put their email address in, and I'm happy to share my musings on wine with folks.
I will.
If people want to know what's going on with food.
All about wine.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And if people want to see what's going on with Bhutan, you know, bhutanwine.com is our website, or you can follow us on Instagram at bhutanwine and see pictures of the vineyards. And, you know, we're trying to share what we're doing with everybody. And
that's
Bhutan
for all of you out there who are spelling challenge, Bhutan.
And it's not in Indonesia.
It's not an island. Yeah. That Bhutan wine is an S?
No, just bhutanwine.com. No S.
Wine. No S. Okay, because it's, be sure. So bhutanwine.com, you can, check that out. Also, his Drinking and Knowing Things book is out, and his musings from a year of his newsletter. You can get a hold of that. And within a couple years, punch in American Masters of Wine, and you'll see him there.
God willing.
there's you could just, if you want to find out more, he's done some interviews. He's been on, he's got different, magazines and stuff that have interviewed him and all that. So all you need to do just to, make it easy on yourself. What do you go by, Michael, on all those interviews, or?
I think, to be honest, a lot of my friends call me MJ. So, I kind of don't really worry about Mike or Michael. I kind of just go with whatever people are saying. But, yeah, if you Google Mike or Michael, or just Google Bhutan Wine.
Stuff
is going to come up.
You can do it that way. I noticed when I was talking to Alex, she wrote MJ a few times. And I go, is this somebody new? I realize those were your initials. So, Michael Georgian and Bhutan Wine, you can find out all about him and all that. And I'll ask you now, but say a year from now, I'd like to get you back on the show and see what's happening and see where you're at and what's going on then. And with your Master of Wine test and with Bhutan Wines and all that stuff. So I knew I could go on the website, but it's more fun to talk with you.
I would love to come back. And this has been a blast. I do a lot of these kinds of things, and this has been just truly a delight and a good time. So I would come back in a heartbeat if you'd have.
Well, good.
So.
Well, I would look forward to it. I'll make a note, and about a year from now, I'll get in touch with you, and we'll do it again.
That sounds awesome. I look forward to it. Thanks again for the opportunity to chat with you guys.
Thank you.
Really,
have
really
a
enjoyed
great
it.
Night.
Cheers, guys.
It's been a lot of fun.
All right.
Have a good
bye
evening.
Now. Thank
you. Bye.
All right. We are almost over.
Yeah. I forgot. Yeah, it's 1 minute. Blah blah blah. Thank you all very much. We'll be back next week. And how long is the intro? 30 seconds. 30.
We got 60 seconds.
Okay. We'll be back in October. The 7th will be the next show.
And I believe
we have
a guest in too. We have a director of a movie called The Wonderful Kingdom who's going to be a guest.
Okay.
That's coming up next week.
Yep.
I'll
tune
get
in.
The
Thanks
information.
Again, and
yeah.
Be
yeah.
safe. And we'll see you all then. Thank you.
Be safe. Thanks for listening.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Ron.
For show information, links to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on this show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.
Oh, sorry. In this.